if you're listening to this, you're still alive. We're on the verge of like potentially World War III, the end of all of everything. And what better time to read Kim Stanley Robinson novels is what I say.
I agree with that. And also, let's just add, what better time than to listen to a podcast?
There's nothing better for you to be doing right now.
Exactly. That's what you should be spending the remains of your wild and precious life doing.
It really does just feel like, I mean, there's just zero anti-war movement in this country. It feels like there's no movements of any kind. And even if there were, that there would be nothing to, that the people in power would have no incentive to actually respond to those movements at all.
Right.
I mean, they've demonstrated how little regard they have for public opinion or even mass spectacle, mass uprising, mass anything. And despite all the data, all the science, all the everything, all the just common sense, rational self-preservation, we're going to go ahead and keep burning fossil fuels and also probably just nuke ourselves into oblivion before we even, you know, by the spring, which is frustrating because I was trying to get into beach shape. I want to spend some, you know, quality time showing off my muscles at the beach. That's a lie. I'm not. I just sit around in sweatpants all day long.
You know what? At least one thing that the decline of Western civilization has given us: comfortable pants.
Man, it's pretty great. It's pretty great. You know, I resisted sweatpants for so long, just with the illusion that, like, no, I'm going to do something today. And then, you know, last year I got a really nice pair of sweatpants, and it's almost all I wear.
When we first went onto Zoom for teaching, I was like, no, you know, you have to, at least I thought that I did this. You have to like change your clothes, you know,
yeah.
You can't like just get on in the pajamas. But not that long ago, I was watching I did for that first fully Zoom class that I had to teach. I recorded some lectures for it because it was a really big class and I just felt like blah, blah, blah. And I was rewatching a couple of those because I thought, you know, I should see if I can reuse them. And I in almost everyone, I'm wearing the same stained gray sweatshirt. And although it's true that I never comb my hair, there's like never a time when it looks like I combed my hair because I've never done it. It's like particularly disastrous in those videos. And that made me realize whatever I thought about like how I was like, you know, getting out of bed and changing my clothes and trying to like act like I was going to work or something. Clearly I never did that. I mean, that was just a fantasy I held on to.
Your hair looks really good for having never combed it.
I comb it right before I wash it, which is about once a week or once every 10 days.
All right. Yeah. That explained. Okay. It's good. Yeah. Nice hair.
Thanks.
Nice head of hair.
Thanks, Matt. You too.
I interviewed for a job over Zoom. Thank you. Famously, I have great hair. I interviewed for a job last week over Zoom and wore a shirt and then was asking my partner if the shirt looked fine. And she's like, yeah, that's fine. Are you going to put on real pants? I said, no. Why? For 20 minutes, for what was it? 30 minutes? I'm going to change my pants?
No.
They're not going to see.
No, they won't see. And it does not actually motivate you. It just makes you feel even less comfortable doing this uncomfortable thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's already uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to interview for a job. It's more uncomfortable to interview over Zoom for a job. Might as well just be as comfortable as possible.
Yeah.
I can't imagine the people. There's definitely people who get in a full suit to interview for jobs, like a suit and a tie and, you know, to interview for a job over Zoom or whatever. And it's like, that seems just silly to me. Yeah, very that's dumb.
That's crazy. I mean, it is also a weird academic thing too, that like people get dressed up for interviews when most people do not do that to go to their academic jobs.
That is the most baffling thing to me. It's so frustrating and confusing. It adds even more confusion to the academic job market process where, oh, I got to buy a new suit to go on this campus visit or at this interview or whatever, a suit that I will never wear unless someone close to me dies or gets married.
Yeah. 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 The one time I had an interview at MLA, which if you do your PhD in English or a bunch of other fields is like the huge, incredibly alienating conference. I bought a suit to wear because I was interviewing and I felt like I had to. It was like kind of a distinctive suit. It was like brown corduroy. So I felt like it was different from the black suits that were the sort of standard in whatever year that was. And I was standing in line in the lobby of the hotel for like the whatever coffee from whatever coffee shop, I'm sure it was a Starbucks, was in the lobby of the hotel. Long line, all MLA people, mostly like nervous grad students getting a coffee, foolishly getting a coffee before going to interview. And there was a woman wearing the same suit as mine. And I was like, look, we have on the same suit. And she gave me the coldest look. And I just felt like, oh, okay.
That's not what this is about.
It was really not what it was about.
We're not here to bond over our clothes. I bought a suit for the one interview I had that was an in-person thing. And of course the suit, you buy a new suit, it's not comfortable to wear. I mean, even though, you know, it's like a comfortable fabric or whatever, but it was also in the winter in Chicago. It was like a interview for the Harper Schmidt. And so I'm in a suit, it's freezing outside. I have a puffy coat, which won't fit over the suit. So I have to figure out, but I'm also on campus all day anyway, because I work there already. And so I had to, wear the shirt, the tie, a sweater, and then the suit over that. So it just felt, and the suit already was probably a little too small because it was the last one the store had in my size and price range. So I just probably, it definitely made me feel uncomfortable and self-conscious in a very, very non-productive way.
Yeah.
Because also you're walking around the University of Chicago wearing a suit. What are you, in the econ department? Bad.
Yeah. Well, if you're in the econ department, you don't have to walk around. You're carried around on a golden litter.
Palanquin.
A palanquin.
Palanquin, right? Palanquin?
Something like that?
Pelican? Pelican. A pelican carries you.
A pelican carries your own. No, a pelican would never carry an economist around.
A golden pelican carries an economist. Giant golden pelican. Okay.
What are we doing?
Welcome to Maroon on Mars. We're reading Green Earth.
That's right.
The compilation of the Science and the Capital trilogy, republished in 2015. We're going to discuss through the latter half of the first volume, 40 Signs of Rain, beginning with Athena on the Pacific, chapter 5, and then continuing through the end of the book, which is like Broader Impacts or something is the name of the thing. And usually we go into like an enormous amount of depth and analysis and digressions. And I'm sure we'll be having tons of digressions, but we're also, you know, I got to bake some bread later. I don't have time for this stuff.
Oh yeah. We're aiming for efficiency. That's our new podcast model. So I feel like, last time, what did we talk about? We talked about like, how we don't like some of these characters very much.
Yeah. And I think that also like that the unlikability of them is a little bit programmatic in a way.
Yeah.
It has a productive alienating effect, at least for me, speaking personally, that understands that these characters have a lot of like growing to do in terms, I mean, in terms of like just they're a little bit avatars for a general situation in which humanity is really having a trouble, and especially like upper quote unquote upper class, like elite humanity is having a lot of trouble recognizing itself for what it is and the dangerous position that it's in. Over and over again, especially Frank and Charlie have these moments where they're very confused and they don't know that they're confused. And there's these moments that creep in and expose their confusion to them. And then they're often it's very easy for them to sink back into a kind of self-blindness until it's not possible to do that anymore. And even at the time when it's still not possible, when DC floods at the end of this volume, it's a kind of, there's almost a sense of a joyful distraction of, oh good, now we can sandbag Arlington Cemetery. Oh good, we can dump boulders into the Pacific Ocean to protect San Diego from falling into it, you know?
That seems right to me that there is, that there's a sort of strong strain of this novel that, I mean, in the usual like KSR way, you know, the novel is not unsympathetic to these characters. Like, yes, I mean, right. You know, I just can't imagine like a KSR novel that was not, you know, that wasn't wholehearted and didn't, you know, find people's inconsistencies and contradictions and, you know, foibles and whatever to be human, you know, to be deeply human and therefore something that we might be interested in and maybe concerned by, but not, you know, never anything like contemptuous of, right? Yeah. But it does also feel like a lot of what is happening, I mean, and this is not something I think that I thought at all the first time I read these books. But it does feel like a lot of what is happening is that we see how enfolded, particularly people from like, you know, the kind of class position that these characters are from. So highly educated professionals who nonetheless need to have jobs, right? You know, like, how much those characters are enfolded into this kind of like doubleness of the routine of work, of going to work, all the stuff that you do at work, the demands of work. I mean, I think it's a little like, you know, it's interesting how much Charlie is a character who is just like actually way more recognizable now, you know, like he works from home. He has childcare duty, but you know, we see him all the time working while he's taking care of the kid. I mean, and none of that is to like dismiss his care for the child, which is like, you know, clearly enormous and extremely giving, right? But he's usually doing two things at once. He has to bring Joe into work on the rare days when he goes into work. He also has the experience in this section of like going into work on a day when he has time and he wants to talk to people and nobody who he wants to talk to is at work, you know?
And he's recovering from poison ivy
in a truly hilarious dad incident. But you know, so, I mean, and with Frank also, and also with Anna, we see them all as people who just like, not the content of their work, but the form of working itself, is something that keeps them like, let's just say like unattuned to the circumstances around them, even when their jobs, the content of their work, Charlie working on climate change, anti-climate change legislation, you know, Frank and Anna as scientists working on, you know, blah, blah, blah. Even when the content should be keeping them connected, right? There are features of work that seem to keep them, you know, kind of buffered by their routines, right? And similarly, I think both for Charlie and for Frank, and I don't know whether this is as true for Anna or not, who I think we have less of a good sense of at this point in the novel, but like, they also have ideological relationships to the work that they do, or, you know, like imaginary relationships to the real conditions. They have stories that they tell themselves actually really directly about what's worthwhile about their work and what's important and the ways it gives them privileged access to truth. That happens differently for Frank than for Charlie, but both of them have a sense of, you know, there is rightness in what I do. And I think also that seems to be another way in which they are kind of impeded from much as they are both positioned to sort of like supposedly work on the problem, right, of imminent climate disaster. Like they're also kind of impeded from, you know, understanding that as something like an active day-to-day reality that's not going to be met by, like, you know, your convenient, you know, your sort of like important to you ways that you stay attached to the kind of work that you do, like the sort of story that you tell about why your political work is important or why your scientific work is important. And that I think is really, we were saying last time, one of the things that feels just like structure of feeling wise really different from the moment of this novel than our moment is this is still a moment in which like part the problem of the debate over climate change is like there is a debate and the debate is it real or not? And I think we were saying, you know, it feels to us like the structure of feeling now is not that, right? The question of whether like the science is accepted or not is really at this point like moot. And the question is like, I mean, maybe the question is whether you think it would be possible to do anything to remediate the situation that we're in while at the same time allowing capitalism to continue. But there are other ways that you could say that that are, you know, less about saying there's only one possibility than that. But, you know, like, so that seems like that's something that's changed. But this sense of like people like going through the routines of their work and telling themselves that there are substantive reasons why they do it. And that in and of itself kind of keeps them from thinking about the crisis at hand. That feels still like very on the nose to our own moment to me.
Well, there's such a, the problem that we face is that we want some immediacy to our action in a way, like some immediacy of our actions would have an immediate result. And what we know now about the world is that our actions don't have an immediate result. Only very limited numbers of our actions have immediate result. Throwing rocks into the Pacific Ocean has an immediate result of making a big splash, whatever. Making dinner for your, you know, child that you know your pre-linguistic child has an immediate result. You know, shut him up. Put a bottle in his mouth. Those have immediate results, but the kinds of actions that we need to take and that we have, and it turns out that we have been taking these hundreds of years after the Industrial Revolution don't have immediate results. They have results that project far into the future in ways that are completely unpredictable and alien to us and alienating of us. Like we find ourselves alienated from our own actions. And something about the rhythms of the work lives of these characters creates an illusion of immediacy. Okay, we've read this proposal, we have rejected it or accepted it or put it in the maybe pile. We had a meeting, I drew on the whiteboard, I got a promotion. Those have immediate actions, right? But none of those immediate actions have the kind of immediate results that are needed to actually address the real problem, which is almost magical, almost mystical, almost godlike in terms of its unknowability and inability to know how to actually, or if action could ameliorate or remediate or change or halt or reverse it.
Right. I mean, it's like that is in part like the scale problem, right? And as you said, it's also a temporal problem because what we face now has been going on actually for quite a long time. And it's been going on in such a way that like the problem becomes rapidly a bigger problem. Yeah, but that's, but it's like a scale that obviously it's hard to grasp, you know? And the other thing that I think is hard is like, you know, we're also talking about something that is fundamentally impersonal, you know, but our response, the only possible responses to it are going to be deeply personal to like every person, except for like the very wealthiest, who will be able to like, you know, escape into whatever their padded bunkers are, but everybody else like, you know, is gonna feel it.
Yeah.
And like the sort of the scale of response is something that's very hard for us to imagine if we only think through the set of mechanisms that we have at hand. Right.
Yeah.
And I do think this is a lot a book about thinking through the set of mechanisms that are at hand, you right. know, like, I mean, and in that way, it's, I think it's always sort of, I mean, I don't know. I'm just like, I'm just kind of, I mean, this is just like a sort of reading of it that I have begun to sense. I don't feel like this is like really like an argument about it, but I do think like, it might be possible to think that one of the things that this novel does, is to kind of draw our attention to, the real limits of thinking the only ways that we have to deal with this problem are through the institutions that already exist. And are through the institutions of the world as it's constituted now. And it does feel to me like, you know, much as I think these books in some ways hold out some hope for those kinds of institutions, also something else is kind of opened up there, you know, like the possibility that like, we might actually have to like, you know, not just think differently or think harder about the problem, but not try to think through sort of like things as they're constituted now. Right.
Well, that's part of that is that the institutions that we think will serve us are the ones that got us here. They are part of the world as it is now. And the world as it is now is rapidly dissolving in front of our eyes, including those very institutions. And so, which is also to say that a new world is being created and new institutions will arise with the creation of that new world, regardless of how much our will directs their creation or not.
Right.
And how much they will be able to satisfy our needs, wants, and desires, right?
Right.
Because those who are in positions of power are also in positions of power, not only in the institutions that have created the world as it exists, but those people in those positions of power are also inordinately empowered to produce the institutions of the world as it will constitute itself, if that makes any sense.
Yes. Yes.
And that's scary.
It's scary, right? That's like, I mean, that's to some extent the argument of that book by Jeff Mann and I can't remember the other person's name, Climate Leviathan, which at least part of what they're doing in that book is they're saying, you know, it's not a given that climate. I know.
The cat, Hillary's cat's tail is now hitting the microphone.
Yes, yeah, she's
instead of just Hillary's face.
She's really, oh, now she's knocking the laptop over. She's very, particularly since her brother died not that long ago, she's like not a lap cat, really.
Aww.
She's not really a cuddly cat, but now she feels it's very important that we check in with each other a lot. But because that makes her feel a little weird, her tail really, she has a very fat tail and her tail really slashes around and hits me in the mouth. She wants to sit on my lap when I'm eating dinner and inevitably the tail like lashes into my food. It's good. Climate Leviathan is in part, right? Like, so one of the things that we have to think about is like, you know, as we think about like, what are solutions for climate change? Like it is possible. And we kind of need to grapple with like, one way in which solutions might come are from new kinds of state forms,
right?
Emergent new state forms that will be, you know, even worse than the ones that we have now, right?
Right.
The thinking, so, you know, it's not like, oh, I don't know, somehow like, you know, the states that we have now will prevail, or there'll be a revolution and the people will prevail. It's more like, you know, there's also this distinctive threat of like state forms that I think we see glimmers of already that would be extraordinarily more repressive than the ones that we already have, you know? It's just like, it's hard not to think about that at this moment at which like, you know, we're already in the middle of like a large scale refugee crisis, but apparently a lot of people have noticed that only because of the war in Ukraine, which right. is just going to be an addition to an already large scale refugee crisis, all of which I think we can think are, you know, to some extent caused by climate change factors as well. Right. And like, yeah. you know, we know that that's not going to get responded to like through, I don't know, welcome and the decision to like open borders and to, you know, like stop incarcerating refugees and et cetera, et cetera. So anyway,
or not fly jet bomber missions that burn 2 gallons of jet fuel per second or whatever, you know, like will only exacerbate the climate crisis. Like that's the one I can't really get over is the military is the number one polluter in the world. And the military is then deployed to protect oil and gas interests. And, you know, so it's just a complete snake eating its own tail thing. Like it's creating the problem that it is claiming that it's going to solve or that it's necessary to exist to solve.
Right,
it's
right,
like,
right.
Yeah. It's like people are starving. Let's grow more cows. You know, that's another, you know, like, as if that would be the thing, give them meat to eat, the right, most right. like carbon intensive food and water intensive food there is. Anyway, that's all bad. as we begin this section of the book in Athena on the Pacific, which is about the University of California at San Diego, Frank goes back there to sort of check in. At his quote unquote real job. That's another thing of like, oh, that's my real job. My thing at NSF is just a year. I don't really have to live here in DC. I don't really have to get comfortable. This is annoying to me. It's not my real life. My real life is in San Diego. There's another great like idea of deferral, which yeah. is all too common again in academia, is like, oh, I got a 2-year visiting position and then I'm going to move to that place and not have any friends and like uproot my entire life and then move to another place for another 2 years or whatever. It's just, you know, this anyway. But it's also in California, which has this illusion also of being the edge of history on 121. California, the edge of history, a stupid idea, totally untrue in all senses of the word. Except for this, it did appear to be the edge of something. And like that appearance is exactly part of the problem. It's that ideological effect of it being on the West Coast of the United States and us all being sort of trained and enculturated to think that like, oh, there's this westward expansion of like civilization and it ends right there. And then great, the whole world is now civilized. And then now what, right? It just, you know, where is it going to go anywhere? Does it go up to the sky and the space? Does it wash backwards over back to the east or something? Like, and I think that something you brought up, which we'll continue to talk about throughout our discussion of the book, that's really crucial to think about is the US focus of this book, the America-centric version of this book and how America imagines itself and Americans imagine themselves amidst this climate crisis, and especially how they imagine their institutions and their reactivity to the, you know, to democratic forces or to science or to whatever.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that this sort of, so we have an interesting, I mean, I wanted to ask you what you think about the, you know, what the sort of status is of like the Torrey Pines generic story in this section of the book, but one thing in this, so in this latter half of this novel, we get this introduction, Athena on the Pacific, is this kind of like introduction to California. And it gives us like the myth of California. I mean, as well as, you know, like some of the sort of potentialities. Frank arrives. He's so happy to be back in the place that feels right to him. We see him decide, you know, except that he keeps having these like frustrating conversations at UCSD about, you know, like his investments and his conflict of interest disclosures, which, you know, he is perhaps a little bit touchy about, because like there are some pretty genuine conflicts of interest that over the course of this section of the novel, he, you know, he does do a little grappling with that, although I'm not sure a real full inventory of that kind of dissonance there. But, you know, we see him like, he decides he's going to head over to Torrey Pines, like, you know, by going like the back way. And so like, he climbs down a cliff and across a beach and up a cliff. And, you know, it's this kind of like beautiful, you know, it's him crossing private property and also like walking down, climbing down cliffs that you're not supposed to be climbing down because of erosion. And the sort of reminiscence of the surfer beach and like re-immersing himself in this place. And we get some nice, something that I think, you know, is relatively rare in this novel. We get some nice like place descriptions and really like dense evocations of place there. And then, you know, and then skip ahead. We end up on like, after Torrey Pines has been purchased by another company and they're being moved to Atlanta, you know, presumably like a middle of nowhere location for people from California, I guess. Like, then we get like, we're atop the cliff again with, who is it who works at Torrey Pines?
Marta and Ben, or Leo. Leo is dumping Leo's house. Yeah.
It's Leo's house. At the moment at which like these sort of huge storms, you know, which are spawned by the Super El Nino or whatever.
Hyper Nino.
And presumably the other kinds of like oceanic changes that we're seeing are happening actually with extraordinary rapidity in this section, right? Stuff that was supposedly going slowly is now going really, really fast. We're back on the top of these cliffs outside San Diego again. And like the cliffs are like fucking crumbling. And Leo is just thinking like, okay, well, I hope that our house was built on like a firmer part of the bluff than the rest of them. And we learned that both that this has happened before, you know, that entire streets have fallen down into the Pacific. And then we get that scene of them just like throwing rocks under the guidance of the Army Corps of Engineers or whatever, throwing rocks into the water to try to like shore up the bottom of the cliffs. So, you know, we have this kind of like compact little tale in this section of the novel, this kind of California story that, you know, in which the kind of like falling off a cliff or the ground crumbling away from under you, like we get these kind of, those both seem sort of like metaphoric things, like the risk that they're taking at Torrey Pines in like, will these experiments pay off? Will we get the investors that we want? And then we also see that become quite literally true. And we know at that point that also like the crumbling of that cliff, something worse is going on than just the slow course of erosion that has been going on for, you know, as long as people have been foolishly building houses at the edge of a cliff over the Pacific. So it's like, that tale kind of parallels the tale that we see in DC, which is much less dramatic because like the landscape is a lot less dramatic and because it's not the edge of the world and it's not Athena on the Pacific. It's like whatever you call the swamp or whatever. Yeah, I'm trying to think of a nickname for DC. I can't even think of any nicknames for DC. And there, you know, rather than the crumbling of the land and rather than the rising of the waves, we see like the slow seeping in and then suddenly the very rapid fall of the rain and the extraordinary flooding of the city. So, you know, both of those like sound like super dramatic, but they also like sneak in here in ways that I think are quite interesting. You know, we get the information that we need to understand that these are not just like random events, but actually like linked to much larger patterns of climate change. But again, like nobody's really grappling with that. And therefore it just seems like, oh yeah, it's raining a lot. We're getting a lot of these super storms lately. Oh, the waves are like extra big lately or whatever it is.
The immediacy of the need to do something now overwhelms the kind of, and like, honestly, like what would be the point in saying, oh, this is all global warming. What we have to do is X, Y, Z. Like, no, there are like immediate material concerns of saving lives or saving property or whatever that have to be addressed at that moment. So like the switch into the, from the kind of projective idea to the immediate now, is, you know, parallels the Kimbalis from last episode, who keep track of the tides because when it's high tide, their island floods. And so they have an immediate relationship to science that America and Americans have so far been able to ignore. And I think like you started by asking about kind of Torrey Pines Générique and that relationship with UCSD and professors there. Actually reading this, I learned a lot about my friends back in California who were all in computer science when I was in college. Got hired by startups, had stock options, went to work for Verizon, whatever, all that kind of thing. And it kind of was very illuminating for me about that kind of attitude. Like they didn't get PhDs or anything like that. They just became programmers or, you know, whatever. But it was very illuminating for me to kind of understand a little bit more of what that kind of attitude / like structure of feeling is around that situation and the way that companies, build, you know, place their offices near colleges to attract young, brilliant minds and get them into privatized, knowledge production, essentially. And it reflects a kind of added, I mean, the other thing, you know, I learned about that. I mean, this was illuminating, not only in that, in the political economy of that, the structure of that, but also like helped me, think about the psychology of those friends at the time too, and kind of was very illuminating in the sense of like, oh yeah, this is the attitude that a lot of people who are gifted in that way, that bioscience or that computer science way, that biotech way have, like, they are very cocky people. They really like, are flattered by industry. They expect to make a lot of money. And they are playing with like building blocks of the world in a way that like other people just don't, so that they, you know, it makes sense that Frank has the attitude that he has. Oh, there's a sign that says I'm not allowed here. I'm just going to go past it and climb up this cliff, even though, you know, it's not only contributing to erosion, but it's actually dangerous for me to be doing this. Right. And that seems to have too, like, I think that's a part of the California ideology as well. That sense that we're, you know, we made it, we live in California, the most coveted place to live in America, right? The place that has an enormous amount of mystique for so many people who live in the, especially in the Northeast, where it's cold and miserable all the time. And you have to shovel snow every like 2 days. and you can't leave your house and you just wear sweatpants all day long. In California, you get to wear sweatpants all year long because there are no dress codes to anything, especially if you're a brilliant biotech researcher or whatever.
Right, right, right.
You go surfing in the middle of the day.
Exactly. Later on in this section, we get, so, you know, Frank in his, Frank is excited to go back to UCSD when it seems like things are going to go well with Torrey Pines Générique. And he imagines on the plane back, like writing this kind of like, you know, to the director of the NSF, this sort of like, fuck you, letter that he also wants to be serious too, you know, like he both wants to say like, you know, you don't get it. I'm out of here and I can tell you whatever I want now. And he also has this very like serious feeling that the NSF could be doing more than it's doing. And he gets really kind of caught between those two things. But it seems kind of like non-incidental to his whole, I mean, and he has this like, pretty intense moment of transformation or revelation or something when he's listening to the talk about Buddhism and science, where he feels actually like called quite directly, by what turns out to be like, you know, a citation of just an oft-cited, story. But then, you know, he has this moment kind of forced into a moment at a meeting by the head of the NSF, where he has to sort of say what it is that he thinks the NSF could be doing. And part of what he says there is he's like, you know, look, scientists, we as scientists could be thinking bigger, and we should be thinking that like it is up to us to do things and change things, and we can do bigger, you know, we can do more in this regard, and that requires us to like have this real faith in what we do and its power to change, right, the world. And so he goes from his kind of like general, like sort of cynical affect to this moment of like making these kind of like great claims for like what it is that science can do, and producing this kind of vision of like, you know, I don't know, like a government that would be run by scientists, right? You know, a sort of like clerisy of scientists, science as like the kind of leading force in the world, because it produces something like a kind of, it is what produces truth and therefore can like grapple with this kind of problem. But that sort of idealism of his, you know, is produced in this moment, is produced also in relation to like, I think the kind of failure of his, vision of like a way in which science is going to make a whole lot of money for him, and not even science he's going to do, but just like basically investments that he has and his consultancy.
And that's also compounded by his like relationship with his ex-wife or ex-partner Marta, where, and it also like relates back to his like separation from himself as well. Like when he first sees Marta, he's talking to Leo, and then it says basically at one point he says only later when reviewing his actions did Frank see that he had cut short the talk with Leo, and pretty obviously at that, in order to follow Marta. In the moment itself, he simply found himself walking down the hall, catching up to her before he even realized what he was doing. And a few other times in the chapter, I don't even know if we're still in the Athena on the Pacific chapter, but he like thinks to himself, there's something very, very wrong about something, right? So it's both that like, his life is like completely falling apart and he doesn't really recognize it in terms of both his professional career and his personal life. They're both like are in shambles, and he's able to like, because he's so intelligent, just continue on with his, and so quote unquote passionate about his work. Like he has like he has several ongoing projects. He's able to, you know, put his focus in that. And then, yeah, once his investment thing falls apart, once he thinks to himself he wants to be back in DC, which is a weird thought for him to be having because he loves San Diego and surfing so much. So it's almost as if, unbeknownst to him, he has developed some kind of affective attachment to his life. The one that he's living in DC at the moment. And then he, writes this kind of almost stream of consciousness, like screed about, you know, NSF becoming a cabinet level position or, you know, whatever, you know, rethinking science's relationship to capital, essentially.
Right. Although definitely not mentioning capital, just mentioning politics. Yeah.
Well, he mentions capital. He says, I mean, in a scientific way, like neoliberal economics cannot cope with the situation. It falsely exteriorizes costs. It's designed to disguise exteriorized costs, right? So it's like, again, that's like an intellectual problem that's separate from his own personal machinations to enrich himself.
Right. Yeah. Unsympathetic reading of Frank
there. That's okay.
I mean, I do think that like, although as we were saying last time, it does feel like Charlie is the other main character here. Most of the momentum of this novel falls to Frank. And like most of the sort of like plot falls to Frank too, including the beginnings of both a romance plot and what at this point looks like it may also be a kind of like a spy story or some version thereof as well, right? So like the kind of, we have Frank both having like existential crisis, and also he is this kind of figure of, he's like the action, the person of action here, you know? Even though his actions thus far have been like, you know, driving crazily and getting some road rage, doing some climbing, climbing down some cliffs that are crumbling, like spotting a hot lady on the train, right. Looking at her legs a lot, and etc.
There's the other part where he spots another hot lady kayaking up the river.
Yeah,
which was I didn't know that was a possible thing to do. Like it's still like, I can't even imagine it. I mean, it must be real. People must do that. But like, again, that's one of those hobbies that show up in KSR books where I'm like, you can keep that one. I'll take a nice walk.
Yeah. Well, she's apparently really strong.
Yeah. Really, really strong.
Yeah. Unlike you or me.
Yeah, I can't relate. What was I gonna say? Yeah, well, he writes a sternly worded letter. He delivers it. He goes to the lecture. On his way from the lecture to the party, he meets the mystery woman.
He goes
to the party. He has a deep conversation with Drepung about all kinds of stuff. Then he decides he wants to stay in DC to pursue the woman, not to pursue Buddhism or anything like that. He's like, I got to meet this lady again who jumped my bones in the elevator. And then he breaks into the NS. It's a really fun.
It's hilarious.
It's actually a pretty hilarious scene. He breaks into NSF through the skylight, does an Ocean's 11 style incursion where he like
can't find the letter.
Can't find the letter. The letter has been purloined. And he ends up like twisting the big mobile at the top of the atrium, like 90 degrees, and only he notices it. It's very funny.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty funny part. That's a pretty good part. From his experience in his sort of like gap years of working and doing window replacement in San Diego. Like, yeah. So he knows how to like lever a window out of there so you can sneak on in.
Yeah, for sure. And it makes me really want to visit NSF now to look at that thing, which must actually... It must be a real thing.
It truly must be a real thing.
But I think the most interesting, his proposal for NSF is interesting. It's not as interesting, I think, as the purpose of science from the Buddhist perspective. This lecture that we only get drips and drabs and little pieces of, because we're experiencing it through Frank's consciousness, and he is kind of phasing in and out of paying attention to it because it's having such a strong effect on him. Another example of an effect that he doesn't quite understand how it's reshaping his brain as he's listening to it. You know, he's instinctually resistant to its message when he even shows up, and he starts out in a grumpy mood when they start the lecture, and something happens to him over the course of the lecture to where he is fully enthralled by Rudra Chakran and Drepung. Chakran. To the point where he believes they're like staring right at him and, you know, speaking directly to him. And the big takeaway is, you know, that Frank essentially realizes that he's been a nihilist this entire time when he hears Drapung supposedly translate an excess of reason is itself a form of madness.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that he, so he starts off listening to them. And, you know, he, whatever, you know, where he's willing to go to this, like his expectations are probably not particularly high, but on 180, he's like looking around the room, you know, all of these like scientists in the pay of the US government sitting here about to listen to these Tibetan guys talk. Frank felt a small glimmer of pride. This is how it had all begun back in those Royal Society meetings in London in the 1660s. Polite listening to a lecture by some odd person who is necessarily an autodidact, polite questions, the matter considered reasonably by all in attendance, an agreement to look at things reasonably. This was the start of it. Which, you know, I mean, on the one hand, I suppose that could be a description of like, there could be a sort of parallel between those early meetings of the Royal Society and this sort of elite of scientists in the, you know, although, you know, obviously the fact that all of these people are professionals and they work in professionalized disciplines makes them like in intellectually utterly unlike the members of the Royal Society. And also, you know, the Royal Society, like, even though those guys who are going in to like do those first talks may have been autodidacts, they weren't just like everyday guys. Like, you know, the only way you got to be an autodidact and the only way you got to do that stuff was because you had access to certain kinds of material means. So imagine it, you know, like, and there's no possibility of imagining like, you know, brown-skinned people from halfway around the world from a place that your people were just in like, you know, the very earliest stages of beginning to imagine how you would come to have like dominion over. No way would you let them come in and talk to you about science. It's such a funny, like, it's such a funny thing for him to think at the beginning. This is like the reassuring thing, like, oh, this is just what science is, you know? And it's a way in which, again, there's this kind of like ideological padding against yeah. like the reason that these people are there in the first place. The reason that they're there because like they are facing like terrible extremity, you know, they're going to get wiped out in their having been like cast out of every place that they've gone for refuge already, you know, they're going to get wiped out by the ocean, having nearly been wiped out by, you know, being made into refugees repeatedly.
As a result, explicitly, exactly of the very process that he is saying was started at the Royal Society, of the scientific method of developing, you know, debating clubs and like figuring out how to, you know, bend the natural world to your will yeah. so that eventually you would figure right. out the yeah. internal combustion engine. So there's a perfect kind of loop there. It was the start of it all. But also my question about that moment, and I had that moment marked as well, was this was the start of it. For me, I said, well, what about the savannah? What happened to the savannah?
Yeah, right.
Because for him, the savannah was the start of everything.
Right.
So there's another, I don't know if that's, I think that's another ideological kind of padding that he is able to tell different stories about the origin of things, depending on kind of what flatters him at the particular moment. Because when he's looking at a beautiful woman, he's thinking about the savannah. He's not thinking about the Royal Society of London.
In which you would have been definitely looking at a lady's legs because it would tell you how fast she could run. You know, yeah, well, I mean, it's Drepung's translation that says science began as the hunt for food, comfort, health. We learned how things worked in order to control them better. And you know, that's an idea, right? That, I mean, we talked about this when we were talking about Shaman. This doesn't spoil anything about Shaman. Mm-hmm. You know, that like one of the really central things that's happening in that book is that we see the emergence of what we refer to as science in the both the desire, but also the need to figure things out about the world in order to figure out more sort of, you know, how to thrive better in the set of conditions that you have. And in the, on page 181, they chant, he who would understand the meaning of Buddha nature must watch for the season and the causal relations. Real life is the life of causes. Drepung translated, this brings up the concept of Buddha nature rather than nature in itself. What is that difference? Buddha nature is the appropriate response to nature, the reply of the observing mind. And here, like, you know, that idea, right, that like, that what matters there is not like that you have something like direct access to this thing, nature, but rather this relation to nature, and that the observation is the relation, right? Not the dominance over the thing or the absolute knowing of the thing, but instead a kind of like ongoing relation and ongoing observation and ongoing understanding that can include the understanding of things that change, right? There's a really, I mean, I think that's like, I'm sure that there's vastly more to say about that kind of concept. But one thing to say for sure is that like, that idea of, you know, that relation is very different than feeling like, oh, but science has figured these things out and they've become like static. They've become static objects or like shibboleths for us. Like this is what evolution is, right? And therefore we can know that we were like this at some given moment in time. So it's interesting that I think that this is like a really, it's a great scene, like, and actually really sort of full of ideas, but the idea that like hits Frank, you know, in his heart is an excess of reason is itself a form of madness, you know, and it's a little bit like what hits him is something like, not like, what if I don't know everything, but like, what if I'm just like totally fucked up, you know, and he goes into a panicked state. I mean, he goes and wanders around and he's thinking about like, he feels panicked. He feels like crazed in relation to this.
Right. So he like leaves, they're all filing out of the talk and he's kind of in this daze and people are kind of in the elevator. What did you think? And they're expecting him to be critical. And he just, all he can like kind of mutter is it was interesting, which is like a high compliment for these people, you know? And on, 187, yeah, he really is like spiraling. He had always tried to be reasonable. He had tried very hard. That attempt was his mode of being. It had seemed to help him. Dispassionate, sensible, calm, reasonable, a thinking machine. And we talked last time, and we talked this time already about how clearly he is not that.
Yes.
Like he is clearly not a thinking machine. Like he doesn't even know why he's doing half the things that he's doing half the time. Like, he had loved those stories when he was a boy. That was what a scientist was. And that was why he was a good scientist. That was the thing that had bothered him about Anna, that she was undeniably a good scientist, but was a passionate scientist too. She threw herself into her work and her ideas, was completely engaged emotionally in her work. She cared which theory was true. That was all wrong, but she was so smart that it worked for her anyway, if it did, but it wasn't science. To care that much was to introduce biases into the study. It wasn't a matter of emotions. You did science simply because it was the best adaptation strategy in the environment into which they had been born. Science was the gene trying to pass itself along more successfully. Also, it was the best way to pass the hours or to make a living. Again, like ideology, yeah, yeah. Like, oh, this is the best. Why wouldn't everybody want to do this? Everything else was so trivial and grasping. Social primates trapped in a technocosmos of their own devise. Science was definitely the only way to see the terrain well enough to know which way to strike forward, to make something new for all the rest. No passion needed to be added to that reasoned way forward. And yet, why did things live? What got them through it, really? What made them make all these efforts when death lay in wait at the end for every one of them? This was what these Buddhists had dared to ask.
Yeah, one, I think like the point that you were making that even as he's working through this, like he is not as much in the grip of reason or reasonable or reasoned thinking as he maybe feels like he is. But also it does seem like the sort of that Science was definitely the only way to see the terrain well enough to know which way to strike forward to make something new for all the rest. Like even in that idea, right? Like, you know, which then casts science as like the heroic individual or something like that, right? You know, and I mean, and not only that, like the heroic kind of like colonial individual, right? Conquer the terrain, make the new thing. But even in there, like, there's a real kind of like confusion between this like sort of pure vision of like passion would never be involved. And you don't have to, I mean, the move that he makes is toward the idea of like just the mystery of the existence of life, which, you know, that may be a mystery, but you don't really have to get to that like level in order to see the problem of thinking that like, you know, there is the possibility of reason not motivated by like passion or any other kind of entanglement. Because like, if what science is doing is like finding the way for the new for everybody, well, then it's obviously, just as the Tibetan guys say, it's obviously about like, you know, the entire matter of human living together then, right? I mean, that if that's what the motive is, mm-hmm. you know, like, he's like a weird version. I mean, you know, I think he's so much more incoherent than Sacks is in the Mars books, you know, like Sacks is also like frustrating in these ways, but Sacks is just, you know, he is a, you know, he's a character, but he is a person who, you know, the way in which he thinks about the world is also the way in which he apprehends himself, at least for like the first, you know, for a lot of the trilogy. And his sense about like, you know, what to do is you do it because it can be done, because this is like what, you know, this is either how I'll prove a theory or this is where my theory has taken me. Right. And that's like not what Frank is saying here is way mushier than that, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. like, as I think is kind of his argument, the argument that he goes on to make about like, what's the role that science should play in governance, you know,
right.
which seems to rest on the idea that like only scientists can be right about the world. But is also rests on the idea that like science is going to be required to save the world from the particular crisis that it faces. And like, those are not the same idea, right? Those are like two different versions, both of them probably overestimating and like fetishizing, you know, capital S science.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. I mean, he has this, I mean, maybe it's another ideological kind of move that he makes to say, well, if I want it, it must be good. Or like there's goodness inherently in the results of science. If good people do it for good ends, and, you know, so we need the right people. Yeah, exactly. The right people in charge, to direct these forces or whatever. And then, yeah, immediately after this, and I don't know if you want to move on, but immediately after this, he's on. Well, okay. Yeah, I mean, there's this meditation basically on the human condition, and, you know, the excess of reason being a form of insanity, and that it's inadequate for the demands of the moment to just simply be reasonable, because it's a form of monomania. But then he's on the train right after that, and he sees the mystery woman, and he's completely overtaken by the urge to just follow her in this monomaniacal way. And they get stuck on this elevator. And this is like, you know, a science fictional moment here. You get trapped in an elevator with a mysterious, beautiful woman, and you end up making out or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that like that basically takes over a huge portion of Frank's story for the remainder of the trilogy. But throughout that moment too, throughout that kind of thing, there's a really great way in which the novel laces in the climactic and like the weather that is occurring, the signs of rain, essentially. Like yeah. It's so hot in, not only outside, it's super, super hot. And this is before, you know, Stan understood what a wet bulb temperature was, I think, which would like really pay off in ministry. But it's even hotter in the elevator. But when they're finally like rescued and they get out of the elevator, there's a line that says like, it's just so hot that all they could do was laugh. Like he and her and the rescue crew, they're just like laughing at how hot it is because there's nothing they can do about it. And I think that moments like that, where the characters are confronted with these like incredible, you know, incredibly extreme weather phenomenon, and they just kind of like look at each other and shrug. Those feel very rich and like important and kind of, again, like we talked last time about how they're kind of their moment in a way. And reading them today, they feel like way more ominous.
Yeah. 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 I think so too, because that was something, it's interesting because that was something that I think I probably said this last time, but something that I really liked about these books when I first read them was how, the bringing home of climate change, you know, or climate disaster, happens here in this extremely everyday way, in the most banal of things that you can talk about, in the weather, right?
Right.
And you know, you get in some of the breaks between chapters, you know, we hear about the chunk of the Ross Ice Shelf falling off, right? We know that the Atlantic currents are getting messed up, right? We know about the Hyper Nino. So we're able to, you know, because as readers of the novel, like we're not in the everyday world, like we're able to like, you know, our standpoint is such, or those sections give us that kind of standpoint where like we get that sort of like, you know, the kind of like total glimpse that lets us think like, oh, it's not just heat. It's not just rain. But it is interesting reading it again, where I think, you know, like there was a period of time in which, you know, people would make jokes about extreme weather as being caused by climate change, but that was really just a joke. But now we've like passed through the moment in which that was like not true, to actually like sort of actual like everyday weather experiences are being in many cases directly driven by climate change. And thus that kind of like the creeping in, I think it still really works, you know, it just feels more like, oh, here we are now. Cause so many of like the large scale things that get pointed to, including the significant melting of the ice, right? Including like, you know, chunks of the Ross Ice Shelf melting off, right? Have happened.
Yes.
And that kind of like, there is something that is quite like, it creates, I don't know, my reading experience of it now is like, there's a weird dissonance between the way in which, like we were saying, I think some of the ideological context does feel like it's from a somewhat prior conjuncture, right? Although some of what it represents, that kind of like immersion in everyday life and not paying attention to it and being really committed to like still doing your job, that actually, I think, very much still with us. But the sort of the signs of rain, and the waiting, or, you know, the sense that anticipatory sense of like, it's not that long before, you know, what is like an inconvenient, like week of like a lot of rain and all of the gutters flooding is going to be something else like that, you know, so there's something that's like kind of, that just feels quite strange about the dissonance between some of the stuff that seems like this is very much of the moment of the novel's writing. And this stuff is like both anticipatory and just like what we are living in now, you know, because I think the chronology of the novel, I think, is such that these things are happening like a little later than the year that we're in now.
It doesn't. Yeah, we don't have any real indication of what year this is, which is really interesting. I can't help but read it as like the 2000 teens.
I think things are moving. My feeling is that like things are moving even faster than this novel.
Yeah.
This novel sort of predicts that they would, you know.
Well, I was going to say that like the weather that, you know, I've lived in Maine now, this is my third winter here. So I have no real, and I don't have any memory of anything, but this winter seems particularly weird and harsh. And a lot of people are complaining about it more than I remember them complaining about last ones. Although the two winters I've already lived through, I barely spoke to anybody because I was in COVID and I, you know, don't have any friends here. But I was going to say that like it feels like this is like things are getting worse weather wise. But I also think one thing that is interesting about this novel, and I mentioned this a lot when we do the podcast anyway, is like, the way in which, okay, the interesting thing about the novel, the positive thing, the thing that actually exists is there's lots of people talking about it with each other face to face or even mediated over the phone or something. And the contrast with our lived reality is that all we do is talk about it on Twitter and Facebook, and the mainstream media don't talk about climate at all. They just talk about weather. And we're ever more isolated among it, especially with the pandemic, but in general, I think we're ever more isolated in our own little homes and bubbles and don't actually like interact with anybody. Like the kind of like atomization and alienation from each other, is preventing us from actually creating the shared reality based in not just science, but direct experience of the world.
Yes. Yes.
Correct experience of the world. We need more people. You know, when you go to the grocery store, you should be complaining about the weather. You should be saying climate change, not like as a like, oh, I heard it's climate change, but it's snowing, which I heard a fucking old moron say yesterday. I couldn't believe it. Like, are you kidding me? This is 2022. Like, that's a joke from 20 years ago.
Yeah,
you know,
buddy.
Yeah, like, no, there is climate change. Like, you know, what's so funny about that, you know? There needs to be more small talk about this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, in everyday life or whatever.
Well, I was just thinking about the media coverage. And I think actually that this I found like deeply symptomatic, and it feels to me. So that IPCC report just came out, which is like pretty fucking dire.
Yeah.
And I got an email from the New York Times advertising like a new newsletter they have, like the climate update, which I think is called Climate Forward or something.
Yeah.
Which is not a good name. And it was kind of like, oh, so we've just gotten this report from the IPCC, and like, you know, this sounds bad. So we're making this newsletter. It's really going to be focused. It's really going to be like solution driven or something like that. So in upcoming newsletters, they're going to have things like, how can homeowners know whether their houses are sufficiently insulated in order to deal with both extreme heat and extreme cold? And I just felt like, yeah, well, I mean, that is the problem right there, is that your idea, like, one, solution driven, you know, and two, that like your idea is, I mean, like literally it, you know, it's going to be like DIY tips about like, you know, if you are lucky enough to like own a home that you can alter, you know, and you don't live on a coast where your home is going to get like flooded out. Like, what's your best way to like do insulation that'll like, you know, be good both for summer and winter? Like, holy shit, that's not a fucking solution.
In a world where, like,
that's retreat. That's us, like, you know, imagining surviving in our bunkers.
It really, I mean, the logical next thing to talk about after this is zombie movies. The classic thing, the classic conundrum they have in a zombie movie like Night of the Living Dead is, do you hide in the basement or do you go out and fight the zombies?
Right.
And that's our future. I mean, right. That is a zombie future that the New York Times, you know, which I feel like must be just completely run by the CIA by now, is giving us. I did also see, but speaking of the New York Times, in all seriousness, I read an article yesterday about a group of scientists. There's one guy in particular, I can't remember his name, in New Zealand, who is basically is an IPCC author, is one of the IPCC authors, and he's proposing a science strike, basically, that, and it reminded me of this very much, Frank, especially, saying like, we've done 26 of these reports. The data is more and more clear. It couldn't be any more clear. We already have all the data that we need. We don't need any more data. So we should just stop doing these reports and start doing something else. And what the something else is, he was not very clear on, but he's framing it as a strike, as like a science strike. We're going to go on strike. We're not going to do any more. We're not going to collect any more of this data that's just going to archive the end of human civilization or whatever, because governments aren't listening, because they have all the data they need. They need to be doing action. And on the one hand, I was like sympathetic with him. I'm like, yeah, I get it. Like, it's frustrating to like be screaming into the wind and the, you know, no government's doing anything about anything. But on the other hand, it's like, well, what is your alternative there? And they did interview a couple other scientists, you know, who were like, well, one of them said something that was really useful for me in my mind, which was, yeah, I don't expect governments to do anything. She said that the best feedback she got was at the local level, like people in like municipalities and towns and places that actually have a kind of more manageable sort of democratic or communal democracy needed to know what they could do on the local level, because like these national governments are just too big and sprawling and controlled by capital,
right,
to respond at all to the data. So at the very least, people living on a floodplain, communities living on a floodplain could actually use the data that they would have to know where they should or shouldn't be building for the next 30 years or something like that.
Right, right. I mean, it is also like, you know, I mean, part of the problem with this sort of idea of science will lead us, you know, which I think in the American context has turned into this like super weird slogan, believe science, you know, propagated by like governments that then are, you know, just like arbitrarily decide like when mask mandates should be over and that kind of thing, right? But, you know, part of the problem with that is like the crisis that we're facing isn't a crisis of knowledge.
No.
Right. You know, like, I mean, that's, you know, that seems like totally right. Like the sort of like the, you know, and it's not a crisis that therefore is going to be some, you know, and I don't think it's ever been something that was going to be changed by like, oh, just finally enough overwhelming facts will come out and people will have to act, right? You know, like the things that are impeding action are, you know, capitalism and the alienated social structures that follow from capital, right? And like the very real helplessness and separation that people experience from one another, because like the demands of reproducing life and taking care of yourself and the people who you take care of are so enormous, right? And like, so from that position, like, what do you do? Like, it's not a problem about whether you know it or you don't know it. Like, you know, the question is about like, you know, one, maybe it's a question about like what might make things feel like urgent enough that you decide that like, for people who have some security, that you decide that you're willing to lay aside that security. Or like for people who don't have security, what might like be produced to give them sufficient security to decide that like they're willing to take these kinds of risks, you know, for like the, you know, for the future of like human existence. We've been really talking a lot about some topics here.
Do you want to stop and pick up later, or do you want to?
Well, I think that, so I mean, the other, besides the sort of like Frank strain here, which we're going to keep yeah. we're going to keep going with, because like Frank, you know, like the Frank story keeps going. You know, the other thing that we see a little bit less of in this section than of Frank stuff is Charlie trying to like work at the level of the political. Right. And he, like Frank, has this moment of feeling, you know, shot through the heart by the idea that an excess of reason might be madness. Like, Charlie also has this moment where this bill that he has worked on really hard and his feeling that the great Senator Phil is completely in line with him and is going to push for it and make it work. And of course, Charlie is like, he works in politics, like he knows how things work. And yet he also is just devastated when instead of fighting to get the bill through, they decide to break it up into a bunch of smaller bills, which are not going to do the work that Charlie wanted at all, partly because they won't get the stuff passed that he wanted to get passed, and partly because uniting it together into the single bill was part of the point. The point was like putting climate change itself on the agenda. We have the sort of like, the senator gives the like, but you know, this is just how things go. Like, this is what democracy is. You know, you give a little, you get a little, and we keep on getting along. And, you know, I think the charismatic senator who, you know, that's kind of his response to things. I was going to say, like, you know, I don't know. That's not a position that I feel sympathetic to or have ever felt particularly sympathetic to. But something that interests me in that is like Charlie is really like, he's disappointed. And it's not that he's an idealist. It's that actually he thinks he's doing the thing that is like the practical thing to do, right? So he, in his own way, is kind of a political realist, you know, and the senator is a political realist. And by that, I just mean, they're both like, this is how you get things done.
Right.
Right. This is the only form that getting things done takes.
Right.
You know, you got to appease this person, you got to appease this person, and you're going to get some no's along the way. And, you know, you do this in order, you drop that one point in order to win this bigger point or whatever it is. And like that picture of like what politics is, maybe that's an accurate picture, although I think like, you know, it probably is even less sort of, has even less like positive content to it than that gives. But like that picture is just like, to me, like quite a depressing.
Yeah.
You know, they are fully caught up in that. It's like, this is what the political is. What else could it be? You know?
They're thoroughly inside the box thinkers.
They're inside the box. Yes. Yes, exactly.
For sure. I mean, and the book, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, the book is directed at those type of people or that kind of thinking, right? And especially what we lived through with like two Bernie Sanders campaigns, two charismatic senator campaigns trying to, you know, clearly the best option by far of all possible options, and just completely being, I mean, any reasonable person would agree to that. I'm being provocative now to our listening audience who I do not want to hear from. living through like two Bernie Sanders presidential campaigns and watching just the forces of capital congeal around anybody but a person who would speak at all favorably of the word socialism, exposes like, you know, couldn't be more exposing of the limitations of this way of thinking of political realism, as you call it. It's depressing.
I mean, I think it's like, you know, it just has to awaken the thought of like, but what else could there be, you know?
And then also like the idea that I like the idea that you said, like, this is what, like, that the book kind of seems to claim that this is what politics is, or it frames from a position of political realism, this is what politics is. And of course, that's like a very limited view of what politics is. And it's a view that's limited in favor of the people who claim that that's what politics is. because politics could be lots of other things too, but just like limiting the range of what, of like the politically possible, the politically imaginable from to the Democratic or Republican Party is the whole operation of, you know, how power works in the first place. So that things that are not within those two parties or things that are that do not appear political are essentially not political from that point of view, right?
And that makes me, so I was just thinking like, yeah, you know, what's the kind of, you know, I think here we have to take seriously that sort of like these kinds of political negotiations are both in good faith. You know, these are like right. good faith actors, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Even like the president is a good faith actor, which is a funny thing for books written during the administration of George W. Bush. But
it's a science fictional quality, yeah.
But the and he's a little Reagan-y too, right? Isn't he like a cowboy?
Yeah,
twinkly-eyed cowboy.
Right? George W. Bush is a cowboy too. I mean, he had all that brush to take care of.
Oh, that's right. Brush. Yeah. Brush. There's a lot of brush. What was I saying? Oh, but you know, like, again, like, I don't know. It's interesting to think here that like, I was saying before, like, you know, the reader gets these moments where we can kind of put things together about climate. So we can read the signs of rain. Like we, you know, we know that there's something bigger, right? This is not just rainstorms. But I wonder about like in relation to thinking about Frank's sort of, you know, what Frank thinks the NSF could do and like what the role of science should be in politics and the ways in which like Charlie, you know, like carries with him a kind of faith in like, you know, the political process, you know, that you could write a bill that if that bill would get passed, it would do something. I mean, this obviously points back to a thing that you were saying before about like the constraint of the very American sort of milieu of the novel, right? But I wonder, you know, if there's a way also that we get like kind of glimpses of like, what is outside of these two, I mean, actually overlapping, like in the space of the NSF, overlapping you know, structures that produce like power and knowledge and also like limit the production of power and knowledge. And there's like, we get, I mean, the outside to that we get is, I think, either in Anna and Charlie and the boys and their domestic setting, which is really explicitly presented as a refuge, in a way that is like both touching and also like it has something very like sad about it. You know, like they don't, you know, their world is just them, you know, they don't have much communal life beyond that. Like, it's great that the Tibetans have come to town because like, they have some parties because of
actually guys. gives Joe someone to play with.
Yeah. Gives Joe someone besides, to play with. Right.
Besides Charlie.
I mean, and I guess we'll get back to the Joe and playing.
Charlie's fears of llama grooming.
Llama grooming. But then the other outside we do have, you know, we do have the Tibetan guys, right? They constitute another outside. We have at the end of this novel, the really amazing, crazy scene of them directing the people at the zoo on how to like let the animals get themselves to higher ground. You know, and in some ways, like the animals, like that sort of scenes, which is a freeing of the animals, it's the unlocking of all the doors of the zoo. You know, it has a like kind of amazing resonance with the scene of bringing animals to earth that we talked about in 2312.
Yeah.
Again, that's not a spoiler. It's just a thing that happens in 2312. But that's like another like sort of outside location, you know, like it gives us this like a somewhat different glimpse. And then at the very end, we have like, as Charlie is going outside and looking at people are all out on boats after the rain is over in flooded DC. And one of the things that he thinks as he's looking around is he sees more Black people out there than you ever see on the mall.
Right.
And nothing, that observation is just kind of like left there. And One thing that makes me wonder about is, I don't know, I know DC is like very segregated. I mean, like most major American cities, is very segregated by race as well as by class. Two categories that overlap each other. And I don't know whether, like, you know, the Black neighborhoods in DC are like low lie, you know, would they have been like especially flooded or not? But it is just this interesting moment in which, like, we get a glimpse of, like, you know, we suddenly get a glimpse of people en masse. It's a carnivalesque moment,
right?
You know, it's a, like, it's not quite a world turned upside down, but it has a certain, you know, it, you know, it has a certain, like, it's a day of liberty, mm-hmm. strangely, in this, like, you know, terrible and kind of terrifying moment. And we see that there are people out in what is supposedly, like, you know, that great American space, the National Mall, who aren't normally out there. And, you know, there is like a little, just like a little flash there of, like, well, what if that's the world? What if the world that, like, these people are, you know, closed in of their, like, sort of professional lives is in fact not coextensive with the world itself, right? And, like, right. What is the story there? And what do we make of, like, it's in the moment of the flood. It's actually in the moment of, like, fucking drowning the Capitol that right. It becomes possible for people to come outside, you know? Right. I mean, obviously, you know, you can't go that far with it. It's just like a kind of moment here. But I do think that to me is, like, interesting. And I don't know, it's telling in this book, I think.
So Charlie, yeah, he like explicitly references Mardi Gras or Carnival in his experience of this. And then there's someone offhandedly says, maybe they should keep it this way, in terms of, like, it being flooded. Right. And that to me seems like just a very rich sentence. That's just a throwaway, but maybe they should keep it this way, should, as if there's an option, right? Like, right. You know, who's they, and what would the series of operations be to keep it this way? That would, like, be the result of intentionality. You know what I mean? Like,
if
the polar ice caps are flooding, you're not going to have a choice of whether it's going to be this way right. or not. And then they is like, well, aren't we in a democracy? How does that speaker situate themselves in relationship to that they? That they want to keep, they want to maintain this kind of new world of Washington, D.C.
Right.
Like, that's, you know, a huge question.
Right. Well, and then, like, you know, the next line seems like it like answers right. that in some ways, right? A Navy river cruiser came growling over the Potomac toward them, throwing up a white bow wave on its upstream side.
Right.
With Phil Chase on it. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, I mean, you know, the other thing that's happened, it may be that, like, the basement of the Smithsonian has flooded, and it may be that, like,
collection is ruined.
Yeah. And it may also be that, like, you know, things are temporarily closed, and, like, monuments look less tall than they normally do because, like, the water's risen up around them. And there's this possibility of carnival, but at the same time, like, you know, this is not all it takes to overcome a state, right? Which is another thing to think, right, about, like, you know, the fantasy that there is a disaster that will conveniently, like, leave the people intact and, like, wipe out, like, the state form. Like, that is a fantasy, you know, right. That's only going to happen intentionally.
Well, and we'll wrap up, because there's this, on this note of contradictory fantasies, right, of paradoxical sort of desires or impulses or feelings, I would just bring up Frank's experience of the flood on 265 and 266. I mean, he has a lot, but the one I wanted to point to was, he runs immediately to the Arlington National Cemetery to put down sandbags,
yep.
Which is like something I wouldn't expect from Frank at all. Like, oh, I got to get to Arlington Cemetery because the eternal flame is about to go out for JFK. He goes and gets some, like, pastries and coffee from Starbucks workers who are just giving them out for free. And then he sees two men sneak around a corner, a trio of men ducking behind a building carrying something. And he's like, no, looters. Oh, my goodness. Looters. It's like there's no difference between the looters and the Starbucks people who he's praising for taking care of. So that's one. That's one thing that I don't really necessarily want to linger on. But it is, it does speak to Frank's like ideology, essentially.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Well, and he says, I mean, speaking of the state, he says to the Starbucks people, you guys should take over emergency services.
Right.
Like,
and they say, we already have.
Yeah.
Well, like, oh, cool.
Good Lord. It might be true for all we know. Right.
Hey, great. Yeah. Let's call up Elon Musk and see if he's got any waterproof Teslas to drive around the fucking, anyway. But then at the bottom he goes, so he, now he's like sandbagging Arlington National Cemetery. He worked like a dervish. This is 266. It was very satisfying. He felt deeply happy, and looking around, he could see that everyone else was happy too. That's what happens, he thought, watching people carry limp sandbags like coolies out of an old Chinese painting. Mm. It takes something like this to free people to be always generous. Mm-hmm. Going back to the prisoner's dilemma thing, but casting himself as a coolie in a Chinese painting, it's like so weird.
yeah it's a fraud. I that is a completely weird moment, right? Because it is like, on the one hand, I mean, we see that it doubles up the scene of like throwing the rocks in the Pacific, which we do see as like, oh, okay, people are pulling together, working hard together. When there's a moment of crisis, people are going to come together and figure things out. And this is a little bit what's happening too, and in some ways, like, you know, yeah, you know, the moment in which people can be generous with one another is often the moment in which they just are engaged in something together. But yeah, that reference, right, to people who presumably are in one way or another unfree and being forced to do whatever it is that they're doing in the painting, like, yeah.
Is the moment of happiness and the moment of utmost sociability, and also frees. I mean, part of what makes Leo and Frank both happy in these moments is that they're actually doing something.
Yeah, they're doing something.
So they're freed of the illusion that they're actually ever doing anything when they're involved in their like capitalist mode of production or just their everyday lives under capital. Is that like it at the highest echelons of like elite science work, you don't actually ever feel like they don't actually ever feel like they're doing anything, quote unquote, yeah, or that, yeah, that it's not actually, that it's revealed to them that they're not actually happy in doing the thing that they claim makes them happy and right, that they right. love doing.
Right.
But paradoxically, what makes them happy is trying to stave off total disaster.
Right. Right.
Living in an absolute now moment that evidently the Kambalis, you know, the Tibetans live in all the time, because their island is at any moment at risk of total inundation.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that's fascinating. It's like, you know, wanting to pull together in response to the crisis. Right.
Well, that's part of the ideology of capitalism, right? Is that the disaster will come finally and free us from the prison of capitalism.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And back to the zombie movie. Yeah.
You're back to the zombie movie. Like capitalism has built into it its own like imagination of destruction that will finally free us from this horrible like situation we've created for ourselves that surrounds us with luxury goods, you know, like, so like that, like capitalism's own imagination of its own ending is itself like a complete catastrophe. And like, so that's part of that. That reflects it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. Like, they're both the same thing.
Right, right, right. And then interestingly, actually, just to like think, just to, you know, like, I think amplify that, there's an earlier section, like one of the interim sections where like we get a comment about like, you know, this is what capitalism is, but it also carries with it like all of these older forms of domination, like right. feudalism, right? And like that does seem to be like, is that what's haunting like Frank's vision of like, here we are so happy and free working like coolies in a Chinese painting, right? Because like, you know, in some ways that's like the idea that like, oh, rather than the impersonal domination of capital, we'd be so much happier if domination were personal as it was in the feudal period or something, you know, but the other thing is like, yeah, I mean, that there's not an outside there. Like that's still like, you know, and again, right. You know, like that's part of the kind of like, that's part of how something like the state also persists, right? That like it's not only, I mean, you know, there is a, you know, I suppose like we live with a state form that's proper to capital, but it carries along with it all of these other forms of domination that like can come out at any time, you know, can and do come out, right? Including the one that looks like feudal domination.
Right. Well, that one is there to save you. It's on a big Navy cruiser and his name is Phil Chase, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, like capitalism preserves all of those past forms of repression and oppression and subjugation within itself and can call on them at any time. It's pretty neat.
Pretty neat. Neat trick. But just a reminder, we haven't always lived this way and we don't have to live this way.
Nah.
Just a reminder.
We don't have to, guys.
We don't have to.
And we're not going to because it's going to get so much worse.
Unless we make it better.
Which we're doing with this podcast.
I saw somebody post on Twitter that they're teaching a class on podcasts at U of C. And I just felt like, I wonder what you would teach in that class. And then I thought, are there people who do this in like a thoughtful, intentional way that you could actually like teach other people? Like, what would we do? We would just be like, well, you just like get some microphones and you like talk.
Yeah, that I would love to see the syllabus on the podcast class at the University of Chicago. Is it being taught in English? Where?
No. I think it's like maybe in theater and performance studies.
Weird.
Yeah, don't know.
So maybe it's like a class on like the resurrection of like old radio dramas in the podcast form.
Yeah. Yeah.
My ontology of podcasts is just this, you and me with two microphones talking until we exhaust ourselves. It's definitely not like New York Times is producing a new podcast that's sponsored by Raytheon. Like those are not podcasts.
No, I agree. I mean, I feel like the one saving grace of the podcast is that like, it can be like completely amateurish, you know?
Yeah. You don't need like an access to a radio transmitting tower. You just need a couple of $1,000 computers and $100 microphones, a couple of Gmail addresses,
a little bit of leisure time,
a free subscription to Anchor FM owned by Spotify, which pays Joe Rogan $100 million to. Yeah. That's all we need. Okay. Well, great job.
Great job.
We got a lot more to talk. We've talked about a lot of stuff. We've got so much more to talk about on upcoming episodes of Marooned on Mars with Matt and Hillary.
That's right. That's the show that you've been listening to, where we're talking about Green Earth by Kim Stanley Robinson.
I have been Matt.
And I have been and might continue to be Hillary.
You can tweet us at Podcast on Mars, or you can email us at maroonedonmarspodcast@gmail.com.
That's right.
We'll be back hopefully soon, in a week or two, whatever. Depends on what happens. If we're all still here.
If we're all still here, we'll be podcasting.
And thanks for listening and goodbye.
Thank you for listening. Bye.